Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate top performers producing better results in less time. This is your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning is my good buddy and co-host, Lee Cantor. How you doing, man?
I am doing A-OK. How about you, Stone? Do you have a good weekend?
I had a fantastic weekend. Are you all rested up from last week's venture to Denver?
Yeah, that was a lot of quality time, you and I. What, 5 days? Another state?
5 days together. We're still speaking, but I don't know. We did like 30-plus interviews with a bunch of really smart folks from Oracle Applications Users Group, but it was a little chilly for you, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm not a big fan of the cold. You know that. And you in Denver, I didn't realize you have to bring like all four seasons worth of clothes on a daily basis, depending on what how the weather's going to shake out.
So we'll know better next time.
Yes.
But it's nice and warm and cozy here, and we're excited. We're going to have a fantastic segment this morning on High Velocity Radio. In a little bit, we're going to get a chance to visit with Kevin Martinez, Options PCM. And we're also going to get a chance to talk with Victoria Watkins, who is an attorney and the president of East Cobb Business Association. But first up on High Velocity Radio, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce from PricewaterhouseCoopers, Mr. Gary Price. How you doing, man?
Doing great. Thanks for having me, Stone.
Well, we're delighted to have you, but the first question out of the box has to be, are you the Price in PricewaterhouseCoopers?
Well, I can tell you a lot of stories about that, unfortunately not. I'd be on that beach in Hawaii if that were the case.
But it did help you get the job.
It certainly did, absolutely.
So what is your role at Pricewaterhouse? What do you do there?
So my job and title is the managing partner. Based here in Atlanta, I cover a three-state area, Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee. Now, that's just a title. What that really means is I work for all my partners and my people, because my real job is to help them be successful.
Now, I hear that you guys took part or, I guess, sponsored a global CEO survey.
Yeah, we do that every year, Lee. We do a survey of CEOs all across the globe. It really gives us a good sense as to what's on the minds of CEOs, as well as how we position ourselves to help them.
Now, that's Pricewaterhouse over the entire country or just your region?
No, it's actually over the entire globe. So, the survey was done globally.
So now, what'd you learn? Anything surprising?
Yeah, we learned a lot. So we got responses from 1,330 CEOs across 68 countries. 167 of those CEOs, Lee, were right here in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And we learned a lot of very interesting things this year. What we learned is that people were reflective on the last decade and how disruptive it has been. And if you think about the last decade, we've had everything from natural disasters to a global financial crisis,
right,
to companies going out of business, to just a lot of major shakeup and change. And one of the things that the CEOs prominently noted in the survey was they have to build more resilient organizations, organizations that are able to manage through that change, organizations that have the wherewithal to manage through the change.
Now, when you say resilient, are you like an organization being resilient? That an organization is a bunch of human beings.
Right.
Are you saying that they have to have the leadership to coach up their employees to be more resilient, to be able to handle this kind of ups and downs?
Lee, people are a big part of that, no doubt about it. So one of the things that people are very focused on is the talent. Do they have the right talent?
Right.
And that's clearly a big issue. It also covers everything from their financial health. Because as you know, going into the crisis in 2008, there were a lot of organizations, particularly financial organizations, that weren't as healthy.
Right. They were over-leveraged.
As they are today, right. Correct.
Sure.
And it also runs to everything from their processes to their technology that they're using. Can the technology survive the changes and the disruptions that are going on in the marketplace?
So I'm impressed that you were just able to get the time with the CEOs in the first place. Did you have to provide them with some sort of value proposition that would make it worth their time to invest with you to answer your questions?
I think, Stone, it's a brand. It's something we've done every year. This survey gets released at the World Economic Forum in Davos in January every year.
Mm-hmm.
So people actually look forward to it. What we do is we do this survey on an unattributable basis. So CEOs know they can talk freely.
So it's anonymous.
It's totally right. Anonymous, and we get some very frank and sometimes brutal answers about their business.
Right.
And I think that's been helpful in terms of, to your question, getting their participation response, because they want to see than what's on the minds of their peers. And by the way, because it's so broad, we can cut the survey by geography, we can cut it by industry sector, we can cut it by city, you name it. We can cut it a lot of different ways, which gives people a lot of good intelligence.
Now, how do you decide which CEOs are offered the opportunity to be part of the survey?
Well, I suspect, it's a good question. I don't have the exact formula for which CEOs we reach out to, but to get 1,300, you probably have to ask 2,500 or 2,600 because, uh-huh. you know, some just won't have the time or be able to.
But are you just going like Fortune 500 or Fortune 5,000?
It starts out with all major public companies for sure, but it's not only public companies, it's private companies as well. Mm-hmm. And the idea of this global, making it very global, 68 countries, we try to make sure we get representative samples from all geographies across the world.
What he's getting at, Gary, is he was not invited to participate.
Kind of hurt my feelings.
Well, you're on the list for next year.
All right, perfect.
So what kind of questions do you ask, and do those questions must change from year to year?
Generally, we try to do a couple things. One, we try to find out what's on your mind, what's on your agenda for this year, and we talked about this resiliency kind
right.
of notion. There's a couple other things that we ask them this year about, really, what are you focused on this year, as well as what are you most concerned about? So if you look at the actual results of the survey right now, what you'll see is a lot of information around what are they focused on for this year, and it's very specific around 2013, mm-hmm. as well as what is concerning you the most and what's going to get in the way of you achieving your goals.
So now what are they concerned about?
So what are they concerned about beyond this notion of resiliency? Growth. Growth is obviously a big
right,
issue.
Right, so they'd like to grow.
Yeah, they'd like to grow, and the issue they have is twofold. One is most CEOs said, and what you'll find in the survey, is that most of these CEOs are really focusing on how do we redefine our customer relationships? How do we get more value out of those relationships? How do we get closer to our customers? How do we create the stickiness in that relationship right. with our customers without spending more money? That's the trick. And what we're hearing from CEOs today is that's what they're trying to do. And that means they got to do a lot of things to get to that point.
So now, are tactically, how are they addressing that? Is that something that you guys as a consultancy yep. help them with?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of different things they're focused on. They're focusing on looking at what customers they have, mm-hmm. what kind of relationships they have. They're looking at strategies around channels. That channel could be a product channel. It could be a geography channel. It could right. be a market channel. So they're looking at those things. They're looking at the effectiveness of their sales force. They're looking at their technology and the effectiveness of their technology. They're looking at social media. Mm-hmm. How do we use and leverage social media to get closer to our customers?
So are you seeing more of an integration where they're almost as like partnerships with companies that have?
Absolutely. That's a great point, Lee. What we're seeing is a lot of collaboration around innovation. Mm-hmm. So, and it's interesting, innovation sometimes makes for strange bedfellows because right. we're seeing sometimes competitors getting together.
Right. I guess competitors almost go away at some point, right, because you're each hitting a market in a slightly different way, and then your expertise, you might be working side by side with somebody who in the past might have been considered a competitor.
Yeah, there's no doubt the lines are blurring.
Right.
I don't know if there's some organizations in some industries where they'll always say,
right,
we've got Coke or Pepsi,
sure.
right? But there is a clear blurring of the lines, and you're right. Because of the way the world has changed, because of technology and other changes, undoubtedly the lines between what's a competitor and what's a friendly relationship has changed.
Right.
So you collect the data, you distribute it back to the participants, you make it available to the market, but I get the sense that you take it internally and make some decisions about refining your services. Is that accurate?
Yeah, Stone, it's really an important part of the way we look at, you know, we're a professional services firm. We're one of the largest firms in the world with 180,000 people across the world, 38,000 in the U.S., over almost 1,400 right here in Atlanta, Georgia. Okay, we have to make decisions and good decisions about every one of those people. So who are we investing in? Where are we making investments? What skill sets do we need? Every decision we make that's not a good decision is a very costly one.
Right.
So this survey and the results of this survey really helps guide us both here locally as well as across the globe on those decision-making processes.
And demand increasing for you guys for your services? Is it staying kind of flat given the economy, or is the economy one of the reasons maybe that it's on the rise?
Demand has been unbelievable. The last 3 years has really been good. Obviously, 2008, 2009 were some tough years in
sure.
most industries. But post-recession, our business has been very strong. Most know PwC as an accounting and tax firm. Everyone's aware of that.
Yeah.
But
right.
we're way, way, way more than that. And our business, our ability for our business, particularly our consulting advisory business, to help our clients deal with some of these tough issues we were already talking about, resilient organizations, customers, and how do they get more close to their customers, is really grown over the last several years. That's created a tremendous demand and also a change in the skill sets of our employees.
Now, is your initial, when you're dealing with a customer, does it typically come through the, first you start out as an accounting customer and then it evolves when they see the other resources that you have to offer them? Is that the typical kind of life cycle of one of your clients?
Well, we have multiple models, Lee, quite frankly. We have clients where we are the auditor of record or the accountant of record, and we provide other permissible services. I say permissible because when you're the auditor, there's rules on what other services you can provide. We also have situations where we're not the auditor.
Where you're not even in the loop at all with
that. Yeah. And
it's just straight consulting.
It's straight consulting, and we're providing a lot of consulting services to companies like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you mentioned you could slice this data 1,000 ways. Did you get as granular, and can you speak to what's on the mind of, say, Atlanta business leaders?
Yeah, that's a great point, Stone, and there are some very specific things on the mind of Atlanta business leaders. Growth is certainly one of them, so that wasn't unusual with respect to the local CEOs here. There was an interesting focus on the threats, and the threats, I meant the threats to their business. So a threat could be a threat to growth, for example. And for example, the Atlanta leadership, the CEOs of our Atlanta companies, are very focused on what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now.
Right.
And they're very concerned that the lack of progress in Washington is going to cause an overhang in the economy, which will hamper their growth. They're also very focused on China, for example. Today you saw the news, China's growth came out lower than expected. I think it was about 7.7%. Most were predicting something closer to 8%. China's a big part of what happens in Atlanta, believe it or not. And low growth in China is going to affect Atlanta business. So they're focused on growth. They're focused on other threats. Another interesting threat they're focused on is the threat of cybersecurity. It's clear that in this town, there have been organizations that have been the target of hackers.
Right, but that's not just random. We're one of the leaders in internet financial security, aren't we?
Well, you know, there may be some patterns and there may be some randomness to it. So we do have, because their internet security systems was founded here in Atlanta, now that's part of IBM.
Right.
But when you have companies that have sensitive data, and that could be in any industry, it could be, if you think about it, it could be a bank. We have 70% of the U.S. payment industry within basically the Metro Atlanta region, companies headquartered in the Metro Atlanta region. So you think about what goes through those companies.
Sure.
And we have other insurance companies. So we have companies with sensitive data.
Right, healthcare. Right.
Healthcare. And so hackers are looking to get to that sensitive data. And it's happening, and it's something that's really been important in terms of our business and helping our clients.
At your level, you're obviously building some personal relationships with some very high-level executives. I'm curious if you have any insight at all. Why is philanthropy such a strong thing here in this region?
Yeah, Stone, it amazes me. I moved to Atlanta 12 years ago, and what I learned when I moved to Atlanta is that it's not only an obligation. You know, the old saying, "To much is given, much is expected." It is a right and a privilege to serve your community and to give back here. And quite frankly, if you're going to be a meaningful player in the business community in this region, it's expected that you're going to put yourself out there in front of tough issues, because we have tough issues, and help protect the community and the health of it. And if you think about important institutions that this business community has focused on, whether it's our United Way or Grady Hospital or the Woodruff Arts Center, they're all focused on protecting those institutions, because what business leaders understand is without a healthy community around you, you can't have a healthy business.
Right. Now, is there any tips you would give to leaders of companies to how to get involved and how to, you know, make an impact in their community?
Well, look, I would say first, there's no end to the kinds of things that one can get involved in. The issues are plenty. This is a big, growing metro region. We have a lot of issues, as we know. So find what's personally your passion.
Right.
That's the first thing I would suggest. Once you've done that, there's a lot of ways to connect through leaders in your own organization, through leaders in the community, to find a way to plug in and get involved and help.
Now, we talk a lot about in here this kind of conscious capitalism where we're trying to business people making a difference. And we, as an organization, we don't see that in the traditional media outlets. And we make a point here at Business Radio X to put a spotlight on business because we have a pro-business slant. Do you find the same thing, that most of the news and traditional media is kind of villainize business people, but in our world we see business people as making a great impact, and it's kind of unsung, and they're not getting, we feel, that the recognition and the you know, the accolades that one should based on the actual things that they're doing. Do you see that as well?
So, Lee, I applaud you and Business Radio X for what you're doing, because we often talk about in our firm, we've done some things in the education space, for example, for 20 years that nobody's highlighted. No media outlets picked up on.
Why is it that the traditional media spotlights the scandal or something bad that's happening, and they're not seeing the day-to-day heroes in business that are making nonprofits run, that they wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for the help of these business people all over the city?
Well, one theory could be that they're in business to sell. And sometimes the kinds of things that gets done on a day-to-day basis by business people to help in the community may not be interesting, or may not sell. But I would
tell that to the food bank or one of these charities, that if it wasn't for the help of business, they wouldn't even be here.
The United Way. If you look at our United Way, every year $80 million gets raised. It's one of the largest United Ways. It's one of the largest United Ways in the country. It has the most Tocqueville members, which are people giving $10,000 a year more than any other United Way in the United States. So more than any other one.
Right.
Okay, think about that, here in Metro Atlanta. And guess where 90% of that's coming from?
Where?
The business community.
Right. Yeah, that's one of our frustrations, is for, you know, business people have a hard time getting the word out about all the good that they're doing on a day-to-day basis. Yep. And then the news, typical traditional media, kind of just focuses on all the negative. And I don't, you know, I believe that the people have to know the impact that business people do on a day-to-day basis.
I think that's right, Lee. The good news is that what I recognize, and I believe other business leaders recognize, is that peer-to-peer, Your business peers understand what you're doing, and they really pay less attention to what mainstream media is saying. And then the other thing, quite frankly, is we're blessed now. We haven't always had this, is that we have a mayor of Atlanta, a governor of the state, one that they're both pro-business. They both understand the impact business has, and they're both very globally oriented, too. So they're thinking about Atlanta and the region the same way the business leaders are.
Right. Now, are you active in the Metro Chamber?
I am. Yeah, I am. I've been active in the Chamber for about 7 or 8 years now.
Now, why is that important to you?
Well, that's important to me for two reasons. One is this Chamber takes on some very tough issues. Okay, so if you think about the issues they've taken on the last 5 years, Grady Hospital, transportation, the water issues we've had, the education issues we've had. Mm-hmm. Not every chamber, and I get a chance to travel around other cities, takes on those tough issues they shy away from because they're tough.
Right.
This one does. That's important to me. And number two, like I said at the top of the show, my peers expect me. They expect me at the table. Right. They expect me to be there. They expect me to be contributing.
Because you're giving a voice from your firm.
Absolutely.
And you're getting heard, and that's important.
And we know that collectively, the more leadership we get at the table, we're going to be stronger.
So that's a good tip for the CEOs out there, is to get active in their community.
Absolutely.
And in their Metro Chambers.
So what's next for you guys? You're coming off of this study with all this fantastic data, but how do you think you're going to be investing your time, you and your team, in the coming months?
Well, good question, Stone. We've been actually focusing a lot on the planning part of our business and where we invest. Our number one strategy is to help our clients with their toughest business issues. We've talked about a couple of them already. We've talked about the customer strategies.
Right.
We've talked about being resilient organizations. We haven't spent much time talking about technology yet. Technology is a big part of our growth in our business. Our customers are really struggling. The technology is changing so fast, it's hard to keep up with it.
Sure.
So we'll be spending a lot of time with that. People. The people side of our clients' businesses is really important. Struggling to keep pace with the skills that are needed. Struggling to keep pace, being effective. I mentioned that CEOs are trying to do more with less. Well, people are a big component of that. How do you get more out of your employees? How do you leverage your employees to get the most you can out of them? So those are all the things that we're focused on, Stone.
Well, I'll tell you, your comments about technology, and maybe we got to have you back, and we'll talk about it in more depth, but it reminds me of that big data conversation that we had when we were at OAUG, because it's not only the technological side of collecting and organizing that data, but it's interpreting it and making good business decisions from it.
There is no doubt about it. You know, we have so many clients that will say to us, you know, I've been in so many conversations, Stone, where a client will say, Gary, we have all this data, but we have no information.
Right. No, that's what.
Can you help us?
Well, it's
and
like
we hear that a lot.
Well, if you look at it from, you know, drill down to your own house, there's 40 million channels on TV and nothing to watch. You know, right. Like how is right. that possible? Right. It's the same thing with the data. You got all this data, you don't know how to make anything meaningful pop out of it yeah. unless you have help.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and that's you know that's been a good part of our business, and it's really interesting work too, because it requires a lot of different skill sets than the traditional. Accounting and auditing and tax skill set.
Right.
So what's the best way for our listeners to reach out and learn more? Website, phone number, coordinates, that kind of thing?
Well, certainly they can then go to our website, which is www.pwc.com. They can certainly call PwC 678-419-1100 locally. They can reach out to me by my email address, gary.price@us.pwc.com.
Well, I'll tell you what, it has been an absolute delight having you in the studio this morning, and I'm quite sincere. I think we got to have you back from time to time, get us caught up on the data you're collecting. I don't know, maybe come in with a customer sometime. I think that would be fun.
We'll love to do it, Stone and Lee. It's been a pleasure to be here, and be happy to carry on the conversation further.
All right, thanks.
How about hanging out with us for a little bit while we visit with our next guest?
Great, love to. Thank you.
All right, next up on High Velocity Radio, we have with us from Premium Capital Management, Mr. Kevin Martinez. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So did you learn anything out of that last conversation?
I did. I'm quite impressed with Gary there.
Are you resilient?
I am resilient. Hey, I'm in the financial industry. We have to be resilient, particularly in options.
So now, why don't you share a little bit? You have a new book out, right?
Yes.
And what is that called?
It's called The Book on Put Option Writing, and the title kind of says it all. It's about how to write options, put options, to increase your portfolio value. And one of the things with writing an option is that you're bringing in cash. You're not really trading a stock, per se, at the outset. You may have to buy it at some point, but by and large, what you're doing is you're selling premium and hoping for an expiration.
Now, you're going to have to define some terms because Stone isn't following you.
Okay. I kind of saw them that glazed over.
Right.
Well, options, the short explanation for it, options are a bet on the direction of
now
the security.
Now you're talking my language.
All right. Okay. So, yeah.
Right. I'm in the truck with you now.
Options are a bet on the direction of a certain security. And it's broken down into two elements. There's a put option and a call option. Calls are different than a put because they're dealing with a different type of direction. Puts and calls both are contracts, and they are contracts that to purchase a certain stock by a certain day at a certain price. And with these contracts, as with all contracts, you have certain rights and obligations that go with those. And each, either the seller or the buyer, has these obligations or rights that they can exercise at any time. And there's four things to know about these types of contracts, both the puts and the calls. One contract represents 100 shares. So you have greater leverage when you're either buying or selling these. Now, that can change if there's been a split or something has changed in that respect with the number of shares that are out there. So that could change, but
I'm beginning to see why you need a book on this.
<That's
right. laughs> Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And the contract also has a strike price, which means that's the price that you're either going to buy or sell that stock at. So that's the price that you're going to buy the stock at. There's an expiration date, like all contracts, it comes to an end at some point. And usually it's the third Friday of the month. However, that's even starting to change too, where they're starting to issue weekly options. And each contract will have a premium, which is the price to buy or sell that option. So you have a strike price, which defines the underlying, and you have a premium, which defines the option itself.
Okay, so let's say that, because I think I've done this, and I just do what my broker says, and right. You know, act like I'm smart when things come out well. But I've done this thing, I believe. In fact, I know I have, where we sold the option, and then they didn't exercise it on the other end, so we got a little cash out of the deal, and we kept our stuff.
Right, right.
So, yeah, walk that through.
Well, what you just described at the very end when you said we kept our stuff was you probably wrote a covered call where you actually...
Of course. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay. And what you did was you had a certain stock, XYZ stock, and maybe it was trading at 20, and you wrote a 25 call. And you don't think it's going to 25, or maybe it's going to 24.99, but not 25. So you're able to keep that premium because there's somebody there that's saying the stock's going to go probably to 30. So I want to be able to buy it at 25. He's going to be the loser. You're going to get the premium and get to keep your stock. Now, with what I discuss in my book, the book on put option writing is just the opposite. What we do is we sell premium against the cash. So let's say you have $20,000 in your account that you're willing to buy $20,000 worth of XYZ stock. You can go back in there and you can sell some put options against that cash with the idea that you're becoming an insurer, that you're going to buy that stock if it falls below the strike price. So let's say you've got XYZ at $20 a share, and you sell a 17.5, thinking it's not going to go below that. Well, if it does, you're going to have to buy it at 17.5. But if it doesn't, you're going to keep the premium, and the person who thought that they were going to buy that and make money on that, they're out of luck. And what's interesting is probably 90% of the people who sell options make money, and 90% of the people who buy them lose money.
So it's better to be a seller.
It's always better to be a seller. It's sort of the reason why there are chandeliers in the casino.
Right. So how risky is this? This is mitigating some risk?
Well, there's not as much risk as you might think. The only risk is you're going to wind up with stock in a worst-case scenario. And then after that, the worst-case scenario of buying the stock is that the stock goes to zero right after it gets put to you. That's probably not going to happen right away. But that's your risk. You're always going to wind up with something. If you're a buyer of an option, a lot of times you're not going to wind up with anything but a big fat tax write-off at the end of the year. But if you're selling the options, worst case scenario is you're going to have to buy the stock. Best case scenario is you get to keep the premium. And like you're essentially, as I said, an insurer. So what you're saying is, look, if this stock goes from 20 to 16, I'll buy it at 17.5. But in the interim, you're going to give me a certain amount of money to take that risk. So you may actually get, let's say, 50 cents for selling the option, and somebody buys that option from you. Well, now, if it goes to 16.95, let's say, your cost in the stock at 17.5 with the 50 cent premium is $17. So you're really not that far off from your break even. We try to keep people at their break even when the stock comes at them.
So this book, though, it's more than a primer. It has some strategy. There's some basic philosophy that you
right.
lay out in this book. Speak to that a little bit, if you will.
Well, the philosophy with any type of a put writer is the cash is king. And you can buy art, you can buy stock, you can buy real estate, you can buy precious metals, anything you want out there. But it's only as good as what somebody wants to pay you for it later. So if you are, you know, if you bought your house in 2002 at $250,000 and in 2008 it was $50,000, that's what your house is worth. You may say, hey, I paid $250,000 for it, but what it's worth is $50,000. And that's kind of what it is with stocks as well. You have the problem of, I bought the stock at, you know, 20, and now it's 15. What do I do? With writing the option, you're just constantly generating cash if you're doing it right. And if you're doing it right, you should have more cash at the end of the day than you had when you started.
Now, is this stuff that can be done with your IRA, or is it separate?
No, this can act. This particular option strategy can be done in an IRA. A lot of strategies can't be. And there are some, most firms will let you do it. There are some firms out there that still don't quite have a handle on what it is. And they won't let you do it because they'll say, we don't allow you to do a naked option, which means that it's not covered by anything. But you are covered by the cash, and you should always, in my firm and in my philosophy of the firm, is I never use margin. If I do use margin, it's
you never use your own margin. You just use mine. Is that
that, well, yeah, I'll use your margin. I don't care. What do I care?
I want to hear about the process of writing the book, because that's an interesting experience. A lot of our listeners aspire to write books. What was that like?
Well, much like you said at the beginning of the show, I can see why I need a book to understand this. When you're explaining this to somebody and you're saying, well, you're going to bring in cash and you're going to have more cash, and people are say it sounds good, but I don't really understand it. And I've had that over the years. And I said, well, now it's time to maybe have a workbook or a book that they can sit down and learn about it. Because so many times you're explaining this and people just glaze over after the first thing, and then they're not getting anything in the next hour of explanation that you're giving them. So I gave it a shot. I wrote a book. I put test questions in there so you can kind of track your progress. I put the answers and the understanding of why that that particular answer is there. So people can read this book, get a good handle on how to do this, and then, of course, call me.
So where can we get our hands on this thing?
Well, you can order it from all the major online retailers. You can order it at some of the bookstores. We're still working on the distribution to some of the brick-and-mortar places, but you can order it online.
All right, and the title of this thing, The Book on Put Option Writing, and it is from Kevin Martinez. Well, thanks so much for coming to visit with us, man.
Thank you very much.
Is there a website? Where?
Yes, you can visit us at www.optionspcm. That's optionspcm.com.
And there's probably info on the book there, too?
There's info on the book. There's info, a little bit of info on how to do this. It's just a plethora of knowledge right there at the website.
Good stuff.
So can you hang with us while we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right. Next up on High Velocity Radio and bringing it home for us this morning, Lee, we have from the East Cobb Business Association, Miss Victoria Watkins. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Well, we are delighted to have you. You've been very polite and patient. Probably taking some notes. You're nodding your head a lot. So what have you learned so far?
I've learned that I have a lot more to learn. So I think I need to order Kevin's book.
You're an attorney.
I am.
Tell us a little bit about your practice, and then we'll talk a bit about the association as well.
Sure. I have an independent law practice specializing in estate planning, and it's really estate planning for all seasons of life. And by that, I mean that it covers the gamut from wills for newly married couples, maybe welcoming their first child, right on down the line to elder law. I do a lot of Medicaid planning, VA planning, guardianship, and then I handle probate sort of on the back end of things.
So what kind of mistakes do newlyweds make in their planning? Or is it simply not planning?
Not planning. and it really, it's newlyweds and new parents across the board. I get phone calls from colleagues from law school who know better. And the conversation usually starts with, hey, it's been a long time. We're about to take our first trip outside the country since the kids were born. And, yes, yeah, sometimes it's kids plural. I think we need a will. And the
so
answer
leaving
is,
the country, that's the trigger, leaving the
for
country.
For a lot of people it is. Really? For a lot of young couples with small children, you know, it doesn't matter to them that statistically they're at a greater risk getting on the
just
interstate
driving
in the morning.
Their car exactly. Every day, but
but something about, you know, going to Ireland or going to the Bahamas is what
really
gets them.
I may not make it back.
Exactly.
And then on the other end of the continuum, I mean, we're at a point in our history and in our cycle. There's probably a better way to say this. There's a lot of old people, right?
That's absolutely true. The aging population is the largest growing sector of the population.
That's what I was going to say, just like that.
And they do have very unique needs, and the needs are in flux, and a lot of it has to do with the rising cost of medical care and the availability of certain kinds of care. A lot of folks who swore they would, you know, die within the four walls that they had lived in, you know, for 50 years are finding that they do need some kind of institutional care. And the biggest misconception is most people immediately make the jump to a nursing home or a skilled nursing facility. And really the in-between place is an assisted living facility. And under some new legislation, a lot of those are going to be reclassified as personal care homes. But the theory is the same. It's a place that provides for your basic needs that are non-medical in nature. And for a lot of people, if they get the appropriate care at that level early on, they never need to progress to a skilled nursing type care, which is where things like Medicaid and stuff, you know, come in, and that's what we hear more about on the news.
So I get the sense that anytime you have an opportunity to sit down with someone and have a conversation of this level with this much substance, they're probably willing to really engage you and very likely become a client of yours. But how do you day-to-day go to market as an attorney? That's got to be a challenge.
It's a huge challenge, and it's because the kind of law that I practice is never going to be advertised on a billboard. And I even tried some print advertising when I started out.
Try the back of the yellow pages?
I didn't, not quite. But tried some print advertising and got a big fat zero from it. And the reason for it is that the type of work I do requires a huge level of trust. And so all of my marketing day to day is referral based, you know, talking to other attorneys.
Right. And that's why you got active in the East Cobb.
That's exactly right. That's how I got started with East Cobb, because a lot of, like myself, a lot of the members of East Cobb Business Association are small business owners. Mm-hmm. And the kinds of people we run into every day that are, you know, sort of end user clients, you never know what their needs are going to be. And when you're your own small business, you get a little more conversational. And then suddenly there's an opportunity to make a referral. So other small business owners, other attorneys, and then other senior care providers are where I spend most of my marketing time.
So can you talk a little bit about the East Cobb Business Association, what happens at a meeting, and why it's important?
Sure, absolutely. The purpose of the East Cobb Business Association is to help our members, who are mostly small and medium-sized businesses, grow their businesses, and we do that three ways. One is just through direct networking. Our biggest events are our monthly luncheons every third Tuesday of the month. And a lot of that, of course, depends on how much a person wants to invest into it. You know, going in, hanging out with your best friend isn't always the best marketing technique. And in addition to that, we try to provide, and Stone, you're going to be helping us with this tomorrow, more educational opportunities for folks to learn about how to market, learn about some of the nuts and bolts. We've had some great talks about financial planning. We're going to have a banking panel later this year to help folks figure out how to get funding. You know, we are on the upswing, like Gary was talking about, of the economy a little bit. People want to grow, and a lot of people are now willing to make the leap and maybe take a loan and invest more into their business. Mm-hmm. So we try to do a lot on the educational side with both our luncheons and lunch and learns. And then there's a huge community aspect. Again, what Gary was talking about businesses investing in their community. And we find that, one, it provides a great deal of personal satisfaction, but being involved in our community is a big component of what the East Cobb Business Association does. And we do that with we try to focus on a local spotlight on our quarterly breakfasts. And sometimes it's law enforcement. We've had the tax commissioner. We've also had nonprofits come and speak to us in that space. So it really kind of runs the gamut.
Are you guys bullish about the economy at the East Cobb?
We're cautious.
Cautiously optimistic,
if that's exactly right. I think we see a lot more activity going on. We see mm-hmm. a lot of people who maybe have been running their businesses from their dining room table for the last couple of years are stepping mm-hmm. out and looking for office space. Maybe they're going in with somebody else. They're not taking on the overhead by themselves right now. But there is definitely a move towards, you know, cementing that this is no longer just a stopgap to get me through. This is what I'm going to do. And we're seeing a lot of passion behind that.
I find the focus on education very attractive, even though we've established you haven't necessarily set the bar for speakers terribly high. You invited me to come visit with them. I'm really looking forward to that tomorrow. But something that's always been a struggle for me, as much as I like to visit, is how to work a room like that. What counsel, if any, do you have to offer for
you? Just become president of the association. That's the lesson.
I mean, how do you work a room like that to get some results?
I think the best way to do that, Stone, is to engage in a conversation just like you are here. And obviously you're good at that because you do that every single day with great results with your guests. And so rather than looking at it as a room of 65 to 75 people, looking at individuals, and you can tell which are engaged and which folks are not as engaged, and finding ways to connect with them, you know, seek questions from your audience. And I find that when I do seminars on some of the topics that I practice in, early in having my own business, I was counseled to speak for 45 minutes and then take questions. And I think that's one of the worst techniques, at least for me, because I get most out of it, and I think my audience gets most out of it if they can interact with me throughout. If just like you did a moment ago with Kevin, if you're not quite getting it, say, oh, hold on, you know, stop and ask a question, and then, you know, re-engage going forward rather than losing somebody at the outset. So I think being interactive is the absolute best way to work a crowd like that. And I think that applies, you know, to 10 people or 100 people.
Now, if somebody was interested in learning about the East Cobb Business Association, do they have to be based in East Cobb? How does that work?
We're not picky in that regard. There are a lot of our members who are residents of East Cobb, and so perhaps they work over the line in Fulton County, or
right.
My current office is actually just over the line in Fulton County, and but they are very vested in the business atmosphere in East Cobb. And so for that reason, they become members of East Cobb. Then there are other folks that's where their businesses are located. And we also have some larger organizations that have branches in East Cobb, you know, some of the banks, for example, or insurance companies, and they're welcome as well. We're not exclusive as far as location. We don't limit the number of, you know, financial advisors that can join. We're really quite open, and we find that our members get out of it what they put into it.
Now, is it affiliated with the Chamber of Commerce at all, or the separate entity?
It is a separate entity, although we partner very closely with the Chamber of Commerce. We all of the, and in fact, Cobb County has the largest number of business associations of any other county in the state.
Congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. And we all partner with the Chamber of Commerce on events and with each other as well.
Mm-hmm.
We try to, you know, give them a platform to, you know, to bring forward some issues that maybe a lot of folks, you know, aren't going to make it to the big chamber meetings. You know, we bring those down to the luncheons, even if it just is in the form of an announcement that we share with our members. And then on the reverse side of that, each of the business associations have honorary membership in the Chamber of Commerce.
So tell us about the decision to become president, or how did that evolve?
Oh, I don't know if it was a decision as much as a woodshedding, to use an attorney term. I had been actually the programming chair for 2 or 3 years prior to becoming president of the ECBA, and it was really just a progression. I had been in the organization and had volunteered a lot of my time, and I have some great people that are, in fact, I think I have 4 former presidents that are still on the board in other capacities.
Wow.
Which is
great.
A huge help to me as far as finding my feet and delegating the things that need to be delegated.
Well, and it goes back to your earlier point in that you're going to get out of it what you put into it. So being part of leadership, really, that really strengthens the what you get out of your relationship with an association like this, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think that and again, it goes to what I was speaking to with regard to credibility in my particular area of the market. You know, the longer that you're around, the longer you're putting yourself out there, you know, giving of your time to
right.
these other things, that's going to enhance your credibility. So from the personal side, you know, I get that back out of it as well.
Now, you have an event tomorrow. Can you talk about that and some of the other upcoming events?
Sure, absolutely. We have – tomorrow is our monthly luncheon at Hollycrest Hall, and Stone is going to be our speaker. What are you talking about tomorrow?
I don't know yet.
Oh, okay.
No,
I'm not supposed to ask the questions here.
Actually, I do know. We're going to talk about leveraging media to produce better results in less time.
Well, and that's something that our membership base is really wanting to hear about. They want to know how they can get their names out there. A lot of people have a lot of great ideas. And so that's and it's an avenue that a lot of people haven't explored as far as, you know, things other than LinkedIn and Twitter and, sure. and blogging, you know, sort of thinking outside the box in that regard. So that's our next event. Next Tuesday will be our next opportunity for after hours networking. And then I think I'm not sure off the top of my head whether our next lunch and learn and breakfast are officially scheduled. But all of that information is on our website, which is eastcobba.com.
And that's eastcobba.com.
That's correct.
Now, do you have a website for your practice?
In progress.
In progress.
In progress. So at the present time, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that the buck does stop here, that it is all just me. And I had spoken to some folks who put together websites, and ultimately, because of the kind of work I do, I would still have to write all the content.
Right.
And so a lot of it has just come down to me putting together that content and then, you know, putting it in a format.
Sure.
In the meantime, I had been doing a little bit of business blogging, both through a WordPress site and then through there's a group called SWAN. It stands for Smart Women and Networking. It's a group of mostly East Cobb business women. And we have a combined blog that that I write on as well.
Well, I am so glad that you made the time to come down and visit with us, and I really am looking forward to visiting with your group tomorrow.
Thank you so much. We're so excited to have you.
Until next time, this is Stone Payton for Lee Cantor and our guest this morning and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.